Hello and welcome to Ideas Having Sex with Chris Kaufman. I'm Chris Kaufman, and each show I bring to you an interesting and provocative scholar to discuss topics in social science, philosophy, history, politics, and more. If you enjoy what I do, please take a minute to subscribe to the show and to give us a rating and review wherever you listen. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Ideas Having Sex. Today, I am joined by returning guest, Professor of Economics at George Mason University, Chris Coyne. Last time, we talked about his book, In Search of Monsters to Destroy, The Folly of American Empire and the Paths to Peace. And that was episode number 20. And today, we're going to talk about his forthcoming book, co-authored with Abigail Hall, How to Run Wars, A Confidential Playbook for the National Security Elite. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me back. It's great to be here with you.
This book, for what is a heavy topic, is short and very fun. It's sort of a Swiftian satire, I don't know if that's fair to say, written as kind of an unvarnished Machiavellian advice book to would-be shapers of a very activist U.S. foreign policy. So how did you and your co-author, Abigail Hall, come to write this book, and how did you specifically come to write it in this style?
It's certainly satirical. And my colleagues and friends who read it, you know, said something like, this is done in a way that the only concern is someone's going to read it and take it seriously, that it actually uses for a guidebook to carry out war, which I guess is good in a way, meaning that we've steel-manned the argument on the other side, or hopefully have done so, or presented in a way that is accurate. The reason we wrote this book was I was giving a talk somewhere and someone came up to me after and said, you know, you sound like Bruce Winton Knight. And I had never heard of Bruce Winton Knight, so I had to look him up. And it turns out that Bruce Winton Knight was the brother of the famous Chicago economist Frank Knight. And Frank Knight had several brothers, and Bruce Winton Knight was also an economist, and he was an economist at Dartmouth. And very few people have ever heard of him. As I mentioned, I hadn't. He wrote a book in 1936 called How to Run a War. And I had to track it down through used book channels to get it. And I read it and I just fell in love with it. And it's written to kind of in a satirical way to the national security elite. And he goes through what is required to run a war. And this just struck me as such a novel way to approach a very heavy, deep, nuanced topic, a sensitive topic, certainly, but it's a very powerful way of doing it. You know, satire as a writing style is effective when it's done correctly because it asks the reader to look in the mirror, to reflect on both shortcomings and absurdities of widely accepted behaviors. And it does so by using humor, irony, sarcasm to engage in criticism of important social issues, of which war and militarism are two. So in any case, Abby and I, Abby's my longtime co-author, we've done several books together, discussed this and thought that it would be a great way to engage these topics and hopefully get people to critically think about war and militarism. And so that's kind of the overarching goal and the inspiration for it.
Did it start off as an article?
It did. So we didn't know if it would work or how it would work. And we wrote up a short, I think it was around 3,000 word article for the Independent Review for this section in the IT journal we have called Reflections, which aren't academic journal articles. They're kind of very open, broad topics and approaches. And so we tried it out there and we got positive feedback. And so we decided to extend it into a monograph, which, as you put it, it's a book, but it's not a cumbersome book. And so it's written in a way which is supposed to be short and breezy and engaging, again, especially given the topic, but also driven by research. There's references and citations throughout. And so we tried to strike that balance between accessibility, but also maintaining the academic scholarly side of things as well.
It was super accessible. And if you want to go follow along with the end notes, you can, because it is, as you said, it's referenced, but it's written in an engaging way, maybe 150 pages minus all the end notes. So you tailor the specific historical examples to the United States, and not just today, but historically, probably focusing on, I don't know if you go before like the Spanish-American War, but the last century or so. But could this book just as easily have been written to the foreign policy elite of other countries, Germany, China, Britain, Russia? Are the general points unique to America, or are they at least unique to a major hegemon like America, or is it broader?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I think it's a combination. I certainly think parts of it could be generally accessible, the broad points, to governments around the world and to citizens around the world who want to understand what war making entails. We certainly focus in the book, as you noted, specifically on the United States. Part of it's because we're both U.S. citizens, so it's our home country and a country we care deeply about, but also because the United States is one of, if not the dominant government in the world when it comes to matters of foreign affairs. And it's certainly been that way for a long period of time. And from that standpoint, you combine that with the kind of view of the American government, both projecting itself, but also many citizens believing that it's unique in a way. It's unique in a way in that, or so the story goes, that in projecting this power globally, this military power tied up with its economic power and so on, that it's unique in that it's used in a way that promotes broadly construed liberal values. And by liberal here, I mean, in the classical sense of the term, human freedom, human dignity, and all the things that are bound up in that. And so part of the exercise that Abby and I are going through by laying out this manual kind of for the national security leaders, say, okay, if you really want to carry out wars, here's what's required. And we go through kind of chapter, each short chapter lays out a different aspect of what's required to successfully design and implement and carry out a war. And what you hopefully walk away with, or part of what you walk away with, is seeing that it's inherently illiberal from start to finish. And to the extent then people are claiming that the motivation and the goal of these various adventures abroad is to uphold and promote liberal values, we're hoping to get the reader to think about that tension.
So you just mentioned, if the goal is to uphold and promote liberal values, but I mean, what if that's not the goal? So if you take just like a straightforward realist perspective that foreign policy, and I don't even know if realists think that the US is following a realist foreign policy. I don't think they do. But that the idea is basically, as I understand it, just all around security. That is, you know, the central motivation of foreign policy for all states throughout all time. Does even on that narrower view of what a foreign policy should be, I mean, how much of U.S. foreign policy even kind of passes muster there?
Yeah, so you're certainly right. So kind of the realist perspective, broadly understood, is we live in a world of anarchy. There's competition in that anarchical space, and governments will act to promote their interests. That's security, that is staying in power and maintaining their power, and so on. And there's a couple things to think about with that. One is, even to the extent that's true, so let's say it's actually true, that's potentially problematic. And I still think the book is of value, even in that context, because it allows the reader, so if the reader is a modal citizen, it will hopefully allow the reader to see what is actually involved with their government doing this, carrying out this policy. And whether they are comfortable with that or not, that's on them. All I can do is kind of, or Abby and I, all we can do is kind of lay out what's entailed, and they need to reflect on what they're comfortable with. But the other thing that you'll see as you read the book and we talk about is that much of war making entails deception. It entails proactive deception on a whole variety of different margins. One of those key margins being disguising and manipulating information that is being presented to the general domestic populace, so the populace at home, in order to get them to either go along with what the government is doing or to mask various shortcomings, failures, and costs that are being incurred because of war-making efforts. And so from that standpoint, one has to ask, well, okay, let's say the kind of realist perspective holds that states pursue their own interests. Well, then the interesting question, or one interesting question, becomes whose interests? Are they the interests of the population generally understood? Are they the interests of you and I? Are they the interests of this group, what Abby and I call the national security elite, which basically in the broadest sense, a broad category, which refers to those in dominant positions in government, so elected officials and bureaucrats, as well as those in the private sector that operate the U.S. national security state. So it's a very broad category. But the reason it's useful analytically is to ask, well, whose interests are being advanced through these policies? And I think there is reason to believe that certainly some interests are always pursued and perhaps advanced through various policies, internationally and domestically. But I think oftentimes those interests are small segments of the more general population, and it is those that are either in positions of political power directly or that are directly connected to that power externally, but connected to it. So that there's kind of an insider-outsider group where the insiders are those connected to the kind of policy space, and the outsiders are the modal, ordinary citizen that actually has very little say, has very little knowledge of what's going on, but does incur some cost from the policies that are adopted by those that supposedly represent them.
So are you operating from, I mean, I don't know if this is, you know, what you would call this theory in like international relations, but in terms of an explanatory framework for how exactly governments, or at least the U.S. government, is going about designing its foreign policy, you're operating from maybe like a public choice perspective where it's dominant interest groups essentially lobbying for various things, and maybe there is no central guiding hand with any grand vision or grand strategy guiding things?
Yeah, certainly. I don't know if international relations scholars would recognize that, because the public choice approach is not a dominant kind of model in their general frameworks for understanding the international space. But that's where I'm coming from as an economist. And so some of the key insights, as you noted, with that kind of approach is to look at political organizations, in this case, both domestically and then internationally, and to think about both the incentives that those various arrangements create, as well as the epistemic or knowledge features that are generated in those organizational contexts, and then think about what that means in terms of concrete policy. And so that, you know, part of that framework is to focus on interest groups and interest group influence and manipulation. But I also don't want to make it sound like they're the primary drivers of all foreign policy. I don't think that's the case. I think they are one kind of pressure point or channel that influences foreign policy. But there's also bureaucracies domestically and internationally. There are foreign governments. There are elected officials. And even if interest groups aren't proactively manipulating policy for their own interests, there are various frictions in democratic politics just due to information asymmetries, due to the lack of a residual claimant or clear owner that is responsible if something goes wrong, that can more often than not lead to perverse policies and perverse outcomes. And of course, the other fascinating part of foreign policy, or perhaps troubling part of foreign policy, is you have governments interacting on other people and other societies that have no voice in your polity. So, you know, public choice scholars talk about things like rational ignorance and the weakness of any single vote. And I think all those points are important, but at least there's a vote for the people in the polity. When the United States government intervenes in Iraq, Afghanistan, it's not like any of the people that are being intervened upon there have any say in U.S. policy at all. And that perhaps presents an interesting challenge to reflect upon in terms of, again, whose interests are being advanced by this.
If you were to take a narrow view that the goal of U.S. foreign policy was to be, I don't even know how to phrase it necessarily, but to protect the broad security of U.S. citizens or something like that, do you think that there's any wars in the last 100 years, or what wars in the last 100 years, if any, do you think come close to passing the sniff test that they were actually really protecting U.S. security interests in terms of like the actual U.S. citizens?
Yeah, this is a hard question to answer, and I'm not trying to avoid answering it, but this is why it's hard to answer, and this is where things get tricky very quickly. And they get tricky because it depends how you define security, and this is really where a lot of these debates fall down on. Even among those who are sympathetic to things like limited government in domestic areas of life, even when it comes to international affairs, there's kind of intense debates about this, and here's what I mean. On the one hand, you can say, well, if we're looking at responses to direct attacks on U.S. citizens, then there's very few cases. You might point to World War II, but even post 9/11, even though it was attack on U.S. soil, the way the U.S. government carried out the subsequent wars had nothing at all to do with protecting the security of the average U.S. citizen. It was just a broad-based war to influence various outcomes in other countries, meaning that it's not like they just went after the people that attacked the United States and then, you know, there was nation building. There was long-term occupation. There were all these other goals. And of course, then you had Iraq, which was largely made up in terms of the justification for invading and occupying.
Well, and even the attacks, 9/11 and Pearl Harbor, it's pretty easy to make the case that these are results of blowback in a sense of previous U.S. foreign policy enterprises.
Exactly. And that was my next point. So thank you for raising it. Which is, no, I very much agree with the way you're thinking about this, which is, so you might start with that and say, okay, well, that can justify those two wars. And then you come back and say, well, wait a second, the impetus behind those attacks, that meaning the impetus on U.S. soil, didn't just happen in a vacuum out of the blue. There were various acts undertaken by the U.S. government that incentivized foreign governments or foreign groups within foreign societies to attack the United States. Now, you still might debate whether those things are justified or not and what the retaliation should look like, but it's very hard to pin down that these wars were undertaken purely in some kind of clean sense of just providing security to U.S. citizens. And then you have these other wars, certainly during the Cold War, for instance, you end up in situations where you're fighting an ideology. You're trying to block the spread of certain governments. So we're thinking Korea, we're thinking Vietnam. And again, you can point out instances of success within these wars, but you have to start wondering at what point does the drive to kind of create a perpetual peace through violence actually create the conditions, as you put it quite nicely, for blowback in the future. And to the extent it actually creates blowback in the future, you can make the argument that it's making U.S. citizens less safe through time, not necessarily in the here and now, but in the future. The hard part, of course, is those things are hard to see in the here and now. You see them in the future. But the way Abby and I describe it in the concluding chapter of this book that we're discussing today, and I like this way of framing it, is we kind of think about it as tripwires. So a tripwire is a wire that's set up, and when it's set off, it leads to some kind of explosion or projectile or what have you going off, some kind of violent act. And what happens when you become, in this case, the United States government, when you become entangled all around the world, is you have all these little tripwires set up. And one little thing over here sets something else off, and then you have to keep getting involved. It's almost a never-ending cycle. And I certainly think we see that if you just look back, if you just start post 9/11, you see this. It's like this continuous cycle of, well, you intervene over here, and then something else happens. You know, ISIS pops up over here, and then you have to intervene over here to stop it. And then this happens over here, and it's continuous, and it's almost a natural outcome of being everywhere always. And that's kind of part of what we're trying to get the reader to think about. What are the implications of having an expansive foreign policy that requires you to be everything to kind of everyone? And it has effects on monetary and fiscal policy and a whole host of other things.
There's an analogy here with Mises's argument about how every piece of economic interventionism results in unintended consequences, negative consequences that tend to require additional intervention, and it's kind of a never-ending cycle.
And of course, the very famous international relations scholar Robert Jervis talked about this idea of system effects, which is a similar type of logic of intervening in a complex system, and you can never just do one thing. Even if you accomplish your goal over here, it's going to have ripple effects. Those ripple effects might be positive, but they might very well be negative, and then you're going to have to address those somehow or refrain from doing so, but it can end up in this kind of cyclical spiral. In the case of war, can lead to a spiral of violence.
Let's zoom back into some of the chapters in this book specifically. So one piece of advice you give for running wars, advice, quote unquote, is to control the narrative. What are some ways that the U.S. government has to do that, especially in the modern world where information is so hard to contain?
So, you know, framing things always matters a great deal. Messaging, that's a normal part of life, and not just in government. That's in business, in nonprofits. Messaging and framing matters. And so one of our pieces of advice to the national security elite in the book is, well, look, you have to control the narrative. So how do you do that? Well, historically, it's been propaganda and information control. And what does that look like? Well, of course, historically, propaganda was films. It was posters, it was radio advertisements, and so on. And part of that was to create fear. Part of it was to kind of create common knowledge or a focal point around which citizens rallied in order to kind of create patriotism. And if you can effectively create patriotism and unity, then what that does is it creates a passive attitude, if not a proactive attitude towards supporting the war, but also it helps to silence dissent, because raising any objections to the war gets you labeled as unpatriotic, naive, soft, and so on. But of course, times have changed, as you've noted. And I should note that propaganda is still around, just not in the way it was during like the World Wars, for instance, when we had things like the Committee on Public Information. I mean, the U.S. government was pretty blatant about what they were doing during the World Wars and prior. They literally set up agencies with the task of controlling information that was presented to the public. And that was their tasks. And they paid filmmakers, they had reporters, and they were very kind of clear about this. So how does this manifest itself, this kind of control of information? Well, the first thing you have to realize is that one of the big tensions for a free society, irregardless of one's political ideology, here's a major tension with national security, which is that by definition, it is a centralized monopoly at the federal level, control over national security or military matters. And you say, well, that's a lot of people say that's good. We want that monopoly control, that centralization, a commander in chief, and so on. Part of the problem with that is the secrecy that's embedded in that. That when you don't have competition between units, that's what federalism is supposed to do, for instance. Whether it's effective or not is another question. In principle, that's what it's supposed to do. But as you have less competition and more centralization, it allows those that are in that centralized hierarchy to have access to information that outsiders can't have access to. Then you add on top of that all of the various rules and regulations about confidentiality, which really ramped up during the two world wars and the Cold War. This includes the entire system of classification of information in the national security state, which again, on the face of it, you get, right? You say, well, we don't want information about our national security falling into the hands of our enemies, so we're going to classify things. Well, of course, the incentive is to overclassify, especially if you want to keep things away from the public or from members of Congress, who at least in principle, according to the Constitution, have the responsibility of overseeing the bureaucracy of the national security state to make sure they're not abusing their power. And of course, Congress is supposed to formally declare war as well. And so what you get is a very kind of streamlined control of information. So how does that manifest? Well, here's one example of how it might play out. And we only know this in hindsight. So one of the great things about having more information flows, as you were pointing out, social media and so on, is that it does allow for more information to get out there eventually. But there's still periods of time where it's very hard to figure out what's going on. I mean, just think about right now, how much can you and I really know about what the U.S. government is doing in Israel or in Ukraine? Regardless of whether you support those efforts or you're indifferent towards them or against them. Very little, very little. Stuff happens in Congress. It's very high level. But in terms of the actual nitty-gritty of what's going on and what the government is doing in our name, it is almost impossible for you and I to know what's going on. And so you can see the challenges that poses. And so one of the examples, and we talk about this in the book, this occurred under the Bush administration after the 9/11 attacks. The Bush administration would feed talking points to a small group of national security kind of elites. So these are largely people that were former military, not all of them, but many of them. They would then go on the news. So imagine turning on Morning Joe or Fox News or whatever. And they would go on cable news, the mainstream kind of channels, and they would parrot these points that were given to them. And then the Bush administration, officials in the Bush administration, would later use those points as evidence. So see, these experts are saying we're doing well, we're winning the war. And this only came out years later. And so if a citizen was watching this in real time and they were getting their information and news from this source, and this was across the news channels, by the way, this was happening, then you would, it's certainly in those moments, it would sound like things were going extremely well, where now in hindsight, we know both in Afghanistan and Iraq, things were going very poorly.
And it sounds like you have multiple independent sources for some fact.
Correct.
And really, it's all coming from the same source with an agenda.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And you can see the challenge. I mean, think about why we know so much that we know about the U.S. surveillance state. It's not because the president of the United States, it's not because a bureaucrat, it's not because the member of Congress revealed it to us. It's whistleblowers. It's people like Daniel Ellsberg, Edward Snowden. that's when the kind of real information is revealed to the public about what's going on. And you know, government doesn't like that, of course, because the minute it happens, they crack down with severe intensity, as well as trying to demean the person personally, professionally, and so on, ruin their life, basically, in order to make them look bad, deranged, and so on.
I want to come back to the whistleblower's point, but briefly to stay on the media, can you explain this? Because you just gave this one example of the state feeding sources as a source to, you know, various media outlets, and then they report on it. Can you explain just this dynamic in general, because this is broader, that exists between the media and the Defense Department, actually governments in general, that governments in general, and in this example, you know, the Defense Department is a major source, is a major news source. So just from a corporate standpoint, from a business standpoint, they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them, right? They don't want to alienate the Pentagon when they are a huge source, and in some cases, the only source that they can have for a major news story. I imagine the same dynamic exists with like local police forces and news agencies who want sources for crime reporting or something. And there's maybe a little bit of a toxic relationship that forms and compromises the independence of the media. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think you nailed the fundamental kind of dynamic that's going on. And certainly this can exist in different settings, but I think it's quite unique in the context of the national security state, the Pentagon, precisely for the point you raised. Again, you have a very centralized entity. They control access. And so if you anger them, they can, they're not going to throw you in jail, even though in principle they could do that too for certain things, but they are going to exclude you from things. And we know this. We know from former members of the media that if you agitate the people that grant you information or make them look bad or embarrass them in some way, there's going to be professional consequences for that. And so you need to tread a very careful line. And we also know from, this is firsthand from various accounts from current and former members of the media, about this idea of being embedded with the military. And being embedded in the military is when they send a reporter over to actually be with certain military groups on the ground. And this sounds great. On the one hand, you say, well, you're going to get live reporting from on the ground people. It's problematic for a couple reasons. One is you're seeing a somewhat sanitized version of actually what's happening on the ground, because the members of the military have an incentive to put the reporters in certain locations and contexts that are make them look good. But also, the dynamics that you just laid out in your opening comments to the question really play out here, which is that the reporters are dependent on members of the military both for information, so their career success, but also their safety. And, you know, typically we don't kind of bite the hand that feeds, as the saying goes. And so there's a tendency to kind of make the people that are giving you information and protecting you, make them look good. And I think, you know, there's also just the point that these people are also citizens and they're human beings. I think it was Walter Cronkite who said something like, look, during wartime, it's really hard even for the most objective journalist to be objective, because our country's fighting, our soldiers are fighting, and there's a natural tendency to want to make them look good and to justify what they're doing and so on. And so there's also just that natural kind of human tendency. And so it makes it extremely difficult for members of the public to get very critical information, detailed information. I mean, there, it's not that it's zero. So you can turn on the news and you can see reporters questioning the press secretary of the Biden administration about aid to Ukraine, about aid to Israel. So it's not that there's zero criticism, but there's certainly not a certain level of criticism. Like, you know, what is actually going on here? Why are we there in the first place? What are the long-term costs and benefits of this? Can you actually give us the details of what's going on? So for instance, tell us in great detail what U.S. donated weapons or transferred weapons are being used where? What are the projections on how many innocent civilians are being killed using U.S. issued weapons and so on? Those type of things you typically don't hear. And so there is a narrative that takes as given in the background, the U.S. government needs to be proactively intervening abroad. They need to be proactively using military force. And then there's within those very broad but important kind of confines, there's critiques on certain margins here and there, but they're quite limited in the scale and scope of what they're willing to critique the political elite on. And that's problematic. Now, the nice thing is you were raising is there are alternative media sources to get information now. And that gives us as citizens some more access compared to what we have. And some of those are domestic, some are international. And so that's always useful, I think.
I'm not sure if you mentioned it in your section on capturing the media, but on this subject, wasn't there an ongoing effort in towards the beginning of the Cold War to like directly influence media organizations and news organizations? I think Operation Mockingbird or something.
Yes, there was government programs that had members of the media on there. Payroll's the wrong word because some of them were being paid directly, some weren't, but they were given office space, they were given information. And these were mainstream publications like Time Magazine. It wasn't some kind of outlier, you know, in the basement newsletter kind of thing. It's not a conspiracy theory type thing. They were viewed as part of the U.S. war effort by the government. And again, this goes back, the world wars were the same way. They were very explicit about, you know, involving members of the media, the actual war effort and communicating information to the public to maintain public support.
So let's go back to whistleblowers. Can you give a little background on the Pentagon Papers and then say, I'm curious what, if anything, you think are the important or relevant differences between WikiLeaks and Julian Assange today and Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War?
Right. So the Pentagon Papers were a group of papers. The official title of those papers is something like the history of U.S. government decision-making on Vietnam or something along those lines. As that title implies, there summarizes the Pentagon Papers. It was a government report. So it was developed by the U.S. Department of Defense of the entire war effort over a period of time. I think it's like from 1945 to the mid-60s is covered in the report. And it showed that the U.S. government, especially Lyndon Johnson, had lied systematically. So it wasn't like, oops, I made a mistake kind of thing. It was systematic lying about the war in Vietnam, its progress, what was being done, the costs, everything. And those systematic lies were not just to the public, by the way, but also to members of Congress. And of course, the Pentagon Papers were leaked by Daniel Ellsberg, who, by the way, is an economist. And famous economist, game theorist. There's something in game theory called the Ellsberg's paradox. He was at the Rand Corporation an economist during the Cold War. That's how he came across the Pentagon Papers. In any case, not to digress, but he made them public. Of course, a lot of people know the history, but just in case they don't, there was an effort to both ruin his life by the U.S. government, but also it's one of the most famous, of course, free press Supreme Court cases in the history of the country because the U.S. government tried to get the New York Times to not publish the papers. And of course, the court said that they could. The papers were published. And of course, this was extremely embarrassing to the U.S. government. Ellsberg was charged with espionage, with conspiracy, theft of government property, and so on. And again, it revealed systematic lying. Then, of course, we have the Church Committee was in response to, the Church Committee is named after Senator Frank Church, that I think he was a Democrat from either Iowa or Idaho. I can't remember which one. But in any case, he chaired the committee. And that was in response to a series of reports called the Family Jewels, which were a series of reports that revealed that the CIA, the FBI were violating their charters because they were surveilling U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, which they're not supposed to be doing. The CIA is not supposed to be operating domestically to surveil U.S. citizens. There was discussion in those papers about the attempts to assassinate foreign leaders, and this was revealed to the public. And among other things, that led to the FISA court was an effort to curtail surveillance, because one of the things that came out of the Church Committee was that the U.S. government was picking up communications into and out of the United States of U.S. citizens with no warrant or oversight. In fact, members of Congress didn't even know this was happening. So the FISA court was supposed to be a check on U.S. surveillance. And of course, the reason I mention this is because the FISA court became public kind of discussion again when Snowden revealed U.S. surveillance following the 9/11 attacks. And so the way I kind of view it is that Snowden revelations were the same stuff as the Church Committee, but with much more advanced technology. It's literally the same kind of surveillance going on. It's just that the U.S. government was more sophisticated in its ability to surveil us because of the knowledge and information it has. And of course, the other thing that became apparent was that the FISA court was ineffective because the Bush administration basically issued an executive order saying we don't have to get approval from the FISA court anymore, which...
Well, and separate from that, wasn't the FISA court notoriously a rubber stamp?
There's a debate on this, so I'll lay out very quickly. I'll have two sides. So the FISA court is a secretive court where only the government gets to present their case. It's called non-adversarial in legal terms because the person that is being discussed, the citizen, doesn't have a say, which is one of the foundational parts of due process in a free society, is that you have a right to face your accuser. So there's no Kafka-type situation where you just get pulled into a room and, you know, accused with some crime that you don't even know. But you understand why they do it in principle, if we're going to explain why it exists, which is that if they were trying to surveil you or I and we knew they were going to seek a warrant, we'd stop our nefarious behavior. That's the idea. So it has to be in secret. That's the argument. Well, of course, the FISA court has a near 100% approval rating, which is your point about the rubber stamp. Now, there's two sides to this, to be fair. One is...
They only bring the best cases to them. Exactly. That it's so effective
that they only bring cases that will get approved. The other side is it's basically a rubber stamp that approves everything. Where one falls down on that, I'll leave that up to them to determine. But those are the two arguments. So then you had things like, where does that lead us? Oh, Assange with the WikiLeaks documents.
Yeah, because it's you're talking about the First Amendment case that the Pentagon Papers brought up. And it seems transparent to me that in this case, Assange is like the New York Times. He's essentially a journalist. WikiLeaks is a whatever. It's not an establishment outlet the way the New York Times is. But fundamentally, isn't it doing what the New York Times did? Maybe you want to prosecute Snowden or Manning. I mean, I'm not sympathetic to that either. But they eventually did not convict and Ellsberg was able to go free. But he was mistreated for a long time. Assange and WikiLeaks seems to be in the same position that the New York Times was. Are they not? Or what do you see as the parallels?
Yeah, well, certainly from the standpoint of them revealing information about government activities, including, by the way, massive violations of human rights and civil liberties by numerous governments, not just the U.S. government.
Yeah.
Part of what I think makes Assange and WikiLeaks unique, and I'm not an expert legally in all the nuances, so I certainly want to be careful speaking about that aspect of it. My understanding is one of the things that makes it unique is that he exposed information on numerous governments. So it wasn't just the U.S. government. And so he's been caught up, and you see this, he's been kind of moved around, tried in different places, charged with different things in different countries. And so the novel aspect of that, I think, is the global scale of it. And so certainly it's troubling the way, you know, again, from what I've read, talk about information asymmetries, it's very hard to know exactly what's been happening to him beyond what we hear from the people in his camp and from other kind of watchdog nonprofit groups. But in any case, it certainly is troubling from the standpoint of you can see how whistleblowing is disincentivized because which governments want to do. So they want to crack down in order to impose a significant cost on anyone that tries to do it. But certainly it plays an important role. And of course, people will always say, look, there's blood on their hands. They're putting people in harm's way and so on. But it's not clear that's the case. It's never clear to me that there are clear instances of this information, these documents being revealed where in some kind of large scale, U.S. military or members of military or other governments are kind of put in harm's way. Usually these things are looking back on things that were done in the past. And if anything, they reveal the blood on the hands of the government, which I think is why governments don't like them. They're extremely embarrassing because they kind of pull back the curtain and pull the scales off the eyes of people. Because as we were talking about earlier with controlling the narrative, so much of the war-making enterprise entails creating and maintaining a narrative that there's good and bad, that your government is the good, that what they are doing is good and necessary, and that they are kind of the upholder of all that's good in the world. Even if they take the narrow, to go back to what you and I were discussing earlier, the kind of the narrow realist view, it's always still dressed up as we're the good force in the world. We're the force for good. We're pro-democracy, pro-liberty, pro-freedom. And what these whistleblowers reveal I think, is both the true nature of these governments, but at its minimum, the true nature of war making, which in some sense gets at the heart of what the book with Abby is trying to do, which is to say, like, look, here is the realities of war making. You know, there's a reason why the saying goes, war is hell, because it is the worst thing humans can do to other humans. It encompasses all of the worst behaviors and traits of human beings towards other human beings. And there's a reason governments have invested historically and continue to kind of glorifying it, trying to elevate it in some sense, because if we stepped back and thought about what was really involved, you'd quickly realize how abhorrent and terrible it is, which at a minimum means we should try to avoid it at all costs. Now, whether you can do that in across all cases is another question, but war shouldn't be the normal. War making and militarism should not be kind of normal way we operate, in my view. It should be at most kind of an outlier situation with an extremely high bar that needs to be met to engage in those behaviors. Because if we engaged in those behaviors in any other area of life, we would view them as the most repugnant of human behaviors.
If police forces fought crime, even in very dangerous neighborhoods, with anywhere close to the recklessness that wars are routinely fought, I think they'd be considered criminal beyond a shadow of a doubt. The kind of reckless disregard, not including deliberately targeting civilians even, but just the reckless disregard and the obvious fact that large numbers of innocent people are going to die, it seems like it has to have a really high threshold to overcome the moral burden for how horrible that is.
You would certainly think. I realize it's a simplified statement, but I think it's true at its core. War legalizes criminal behavior because, as you put it, you know, in other areas of life, this would be viewed as criminal behavior. It is. It legalizes it both formally, meaning people, governments are allowed to do things to other people that they otherwise wouldn't be able to do, but also it normalizes it internally. It allows you to treat other human beings in ways that you normally wouldn't, which, by the way, if you look historically at propaganda, what's one of the things it does? It dehumanizes other people. There's a reason if you look back at World War II, U.S. propaganda has Japanese people looking like rats or like bugs. What do you do with rats and bugs when you're in your house? You kill them and you don't think twice about it because you don't view them as being equal to you as a being. They are vermin that needs to be, you know, annihilated. And it makes it easier to treat other human beings as if they're not. And that's an important thing to remember.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me, I learned something new in this book that it's obvious in retrospect. It should have been obvious to me. So Americans may not pay much attention to civilian casualties in the wars that our government fights. But nevertheless, civilian casualties are not popular. That's a point against wars. To the extent that Americans know about them or that it's publicized, it's an unpopular thing. And that's why it's maybe best from the foreign policy elite's perspective to minimize knowledge of that for PR purposes. But you point out something else, though, that there's actually quite a lot of gray area in the definitions of how, say, civilians as opposed to combatants are even defined. And that's another way you can minimize, say, civilian casualties. Can you say something about the idea of the military-aged male and how that might be used to gloss over civilian casualties?
Yes. So this is an important point, so thank you for raising it. And let's step back for a moment and understand the context because, again, this is what is required to engage in war making, which is the point of the book. It's to get people to think about these are actually the things that you need to do. And one of the things you need to do is intervene in another society and you need to attack an enemy. Then the question becomes, who's the enemy? And historically, that was easier. You have these people in this military uniform, these people in this military uniform, and way, way back, they just march and you kind of shot at the other marching people. And then warfare changed, of course. They still had uniforms on and maybe you were in trenches or you had planes or tanks, but you could at least more easily identify that army and this army. Of course, as you moved into various forms of warfare, which again have existed throughout history, but a lot of wars presently are like this, you have people that aren't in uniform and you have insurgencies. And within those insurgencies, it's not always just a single group. It's numerous subgroups. So how do you identify these people and to fight them? Because if you're going to drop bombs, if you're going to shoot people, you need to figure out who to do that to. Well, it's really hard to do, turns out. So that's the challenge. So what has been done? Well, certainly as part of the war on terror, but this goes back to at least Vietnam, this was done too, is this category of a military-aged male. And the idea was that, look, because we're in this conflict situation and we have these asymmetries of information, it's hard for us to identify who the enemy is. We are going to come up with some general characteristics that allow us to identify people and categorize them. And so here it's something like male, so gender. If you're a male and you're of a certain age, right, whether that's 16, 17, 18, you are automatically characterized as a combatant, unless evidence exists to the contrary. Of course, in a real-time war situation, you're not going to sit there and try to figure this out. So what happens? Well, you shoot first, whether it's a gun, a drone, a fighter jet, whatever you're shooting with or from, sky or ground. And then you ask questions later, if you ask questions at all. But one of the way this insulates people, I mentioned already, it gives you a sense of justification for shooting someone or for bombing someone, which is that I can see you're a male. Let's assume I can see that. I think you're of a certain age. Now I'm justified to shoot you. So it insulates me from having to justify or be guilty of some crime. This goes back to what you and I were just talking about. Imagine walking around in the normal world and saying that's a male of a certain age, and so therefore I can do harm to them. We would never think in those terms. And if someone spoke in those terms, we would find it quite repugnant. But it also allows members of governments to deflate the number of innocents that are killed to the extent they track those numbers at all. Because let's say you bomb something. This was very popular during the use of drones in Afghanistan and Iraq too, but especially in Afghanistan. You'd have a drone, the US would use drones. They would kill a group of people. And then they could just say, see, no civilians were killed because everyone fit the category of a military age male in that area. And that's the end of it. And so then they can say, see, we don't kill any innocent civilians at all. The problem is you can't tell. Just because someone's a male of a certain age, assume you get that information correct, you still can't tell whether they're a militant or not. It's extremely hard to do. And then after the fact, how are you going to figure that out? So that's problematic. Then there are other things built into that, by the way. The military age male is one aspect. The other is what was called, and still is, it's called signature strikes. And so again, imagine looking from high above from a drone camera, and you're looking down. It's hard to make out details. And so you look for certain signature behaviors which governments have determined are correlated with insurgents. So what would that look like? A large group of males together. By large, I don't mean like hundreds. It could be like 5, 10, because they could be plotting something. A caravan of cars. So you may or may not remember one of the famous kind of things that became public during the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan was, this happened more than once, but a wedding party was destroyed by a drone. Why was it destroyed? Because they were using signature strikes as a category. So you had a caravan of cars. You and I would call that a wedding party, just like you and I might drive to a wedding in a row of cars. It just so happens other people do too. They're human beings who celebrate things. And they just destroyed them. And you can see how this can lead to gross violations of basic human rights. But again, it's such a general categorization of other people that it really opens the door to really terrible behaviors. And it insulates people from taking responsibility from their actions. And that's what the point of it is, by the way. Again, they'll say things, proponents of this will say, well, what do you want us to do? Contingent on being there, we need to fight people. We don't have time to sort this out. We can't go up and ask people because the militants will shoot back at us and do all the research. So unfortunately, you know, as we put it in the book, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet. That's one of the lines in the book we have. And of course, we mean in a satirical, sarcastic tone, but that's kind of the mentality you have to have. It's a necessary fact of war. You need to break some eggs to break some omelets. In this case, the eggs are human beings and you're going to kill innocent human beings.
And that's definitely true, which to my mind pushes the argument back a step to say, this is why the justificatory burden should be so high for engaging in war, because you know that the things you're going to end up doing are so terrible, even if you're on the quote-unquote good side of the war. Hey everyone, this is Chris Kaufman, and I just wanted to take a break to thank you all from the bottom of my heart for listening to these episodes.
and giving me the opportunity to speak with people I admire and read amazing books every week, every other week, whatever. If you are interested in helping this little engine that could of a show grow, please just recommend it to a friend. Recommend it to a friend. Maybe give it a 5-star rating on one of those places you listen to it at. But really, if you just recommend it to someone, that goes a long way for a small show like this. So thank you again. Thank you for listening. Keep listening. And back to the show.
Okay, so this was a obviously satirical book giving advice to the foreign policy elite as if you were advising them to be, you know, pursuing this grand liberal empire. If you actually had the ear of foreign policy elite somehow, what goal would you hope that they would aim at in the long term? And what specific advice might you give them in the short term in terms of U.S. foreign policy reforms, short term and long term aims?
Yeah, well, those are big questions. And somewhat, again, not to avoid it, but somewhat at odds with my internal fabric, because, you know, one of the things very much I'm against are kind of advisors and experts who claim to know what policy should look like. And one of the main takeaways from a lot of my work is that a lot of foreign policy discussions treat the world as if it's this concrete thing that can have certain specific targeted policies, but they actually don't work out that way. That's not how the world is once we move towards it. But that all said, I would be cautious of that. I do think there are general kind of principles that we can perhaps follow and think about that are often overlooked. And so personally, I would advocate for things that reduced the likelihood of violent conflict. And so, you know, this goes back to what you and I were just talking about earlier, which is that if you think the bar for war making should be sufficiently high, and I realize that the word sufficient there is doing a lot of work because we need to think about what that actually means, but nonetheless, then we should take all possible steps or as many steps as possible to avoid violent conflict. And that requires diplomacy, that requires appeasement, that requires also perceptions. There's the kind of classic thing in international relations, or one of the classic situations, is a prisoner's dilemma. The prisoner's dilemma idea that underpins things like the arms race and a lot of conflicts kind of spiraling.
The is idea the same thing as the security dilemma in IR?
The security dilemma, it's related to that, right? So the security dilemma is you do something to make yourself safer. You ramp up arms or whatever, and that makes me less safe, so I respond in kind. So it's a similar kind of logic. The prisoner's dilemma being we don't have an incentive to cooperate, we have an incentive to defect. So it's similar type logic, right? There's another important, though, perspective that I think is missed, which is that we have this idea of a perceptual dilemma. A perceptual dilemma is maybe I really want to cooperate with you, but you're sending off strong signals. You're kind of puffing out your chest about how tough you are. So I fear that if I express my ability to cooperate with you, you'll take advantage of it and harm me. And any kind of compromise, any kind of agreement requires the parties to have, number one, some baseline respect for each other, but also confident that the other party is going to follow through on their agreement. And one of the risks you run when you engage in focusing purely on military, whether you want to put it in terms of arms, whether you want to put it in terms of arms accumulation, whether you want to put it in terms of deterrence, is that it creates a perception there's little to no room for agreement, for coexistence. And you see some of this language right now with China, for instance, with the way people in the U.S. government talk. And proponents of that would say, well, we need that because it deters them from doing things. But a critique of that position is it makes conflict more likely. Because if other people think the only way now to deal with you is by ramping things up and by playing tough themselves and puffing their chest out, it makes violence and war more likely. So I personally am a proponent of trying to do everything within one's power to minimize the likelihood of violence. And if violence does occur, the goal then should be to end it as quickly as possible. And so a position that seeks those things out, which I realize can be context specific, is extremely important. Economically, I think free trade, open trade, movements towards reducing immigration restrictions are all key parts of this. And of course, economists have talked about this for long periods of time. But one of the challenges you face now in the world is economic nationalism is on the rise again. That's the idea of whether it's the kind of MAGA movement, but even non-MAGA people, the people that claim not to subscribe to the Make America Great Again kind of ideology, many of them are still heavily protectionist. And one of the challenges with that is, again, you create economic warfare. That's what that is. We forget that. We think about trade policy and economic policy almost being very kind of sterile. And, oh, it's an all an academic exercise about trade policy. Well, what is trade policy when you restrict and block trade other than preventing human beings from interacting with people, backstopped by government force? And that the very nature of those policies creates tensions, it creates conflict, and it creates, again, an increasing likelihood of a spiral. So I would advise any movement towards peace. Let's elevate peace. And everyone says they're for peace, but there's a difference, I think, which is that I personally don't view war making as the recipe to get peace. You know, you can't get peace through violence. You can't force people to be peaceful, because ultimately what you are requiring is continued force in order to get people to behave like they are peaceful, meaning that a truly free society, a truly free world requires people to voluntarily accept that they can coexist with other people. That's what it requires. Now, that might be an ideal that we can't achieve perfectly. Of course not, because there's going to always be tensions and conflict in the world. Some of those will spiral into violence. But there is a lot of scope in the world for increasing toleration, for looking for various margins whereby people can peacefully coexist. I think a lot of those things get shut off under the current foreign policy. So minimizing likelihood of violence. The U.S. government's the world's largest arms dealer. Cut that back. Cut back military aid. Things like economic development, humanitarian aid, which I think are oftentimes wasted, but that's a different discussion. But I'm talking aid that goes to buying weapons and promoting conflict. And look for opportunities to engage in diplomacy as much as possible. That will not end all violence. It will certainly not end all conflict, which is a ubiquitous part of life. But I think it will go a long way in helping us frame the world not as a negative sum world where some win and some lose and some people have to die and some people get to live, but of one of coexistence. And again, that's what we strive for domestically. At least that's what people purport to strive for domestically. So it seems like we should be striving for it internationally as well. I would pull back U.S. troops from around the world. I realize people will say, well, then who's going to create order? I don't think the U.S. government creates order. I think it creates a type of order, but that order is based on force and illiberal ends, both means and ends, as we talked about earlier. So I would also look for pulling back U.S. troops. And I would actually say, look, Department of Defense, you're named the Department of Defense, not the War Department. It used to be called the War Department. Now it's called the Department of Defense. So let's defend. What does defense mean? Well, I have a more narrow view of what defense means, which means defending America, the actual landmass America. And that necessarily entails a very restricted foreign policy. So going back to where we started this discussion, my own view of security and defense is not going all around the world and preemptively striking people that might supposedly cause issues in the future. It's also not protecting business interests. So it's not intervening in other countries because a U.S.-based company had their property expropriated. I think that's terrible, but I think that's built into their risk in investing. I don't think that's the role of the U.S. military. I certainly don't think it provides you and I as citizens with any security. And so all of those things I would push off the table immediately. Those in themselves would be quite radical. Any of them I'd be happy with as starting points.
I've always wondered, and I don't know if people have written about this, but so I'm a fan of Switzerland, relatively speaking, but I'm a fan of their foreign policy, certainly relative to the United States's. And I always wondered, does something like the Swiss model of arms neutrality, and not just arms neutrality, but their military is more decentralized in a lot of ways. Does some kind of more decentralized, semi-organized militia-based system of principled arms neutrality, is that not a reasonable way to solve the security dilemma of simultaneously arming yourself, but doing it in a way that is minimally offensive? and tells other people, look, we are going to be a huge pain in the ass to invade, but we don't have much in the way of offensive capabilities. Is that not a reasonable way, especially if you're a rich country, is that not a reasonable way to get past the security dilemma?
Yes, it's certainly one way to get around it. And not in this book, in the last book, In Search of Monsters to Destroy, in the last chapter, I talked a little bit about this idea of polycentric defense and this idea of moving away our conception from, well, the national government has to provide defense over there, which really is offense. As you put it quite nicely, there's a difference between defense and offense. And what would that look like? And part of that can be guns and weapons, but it doesn't have to be. Defense can also just be, well, we're difficult to occupy because we're going to put up a stink if you try to invade our country kind of thing. Now, here's the response to that, to be fair. Some people would say that Switzerland is able to maintain that position.
That they're free riding.
Exactly, because of the security umbrella. So if something really went kind of south, the U.S. would be there, or U.S. or others would be there to kind of bail them out. Whether that's true or not, that kind of argument is difficult to evaluate in practice because we don't have an actual example of it not existing, that overarching thing, kind of umbrella to argue against. But I certainly think the way you're thinking is at a minimum a useful thought exercise because it gets us to reflect on, well, does the current system, the way it's laid out now currently, does it really need to be that way? I don't think it does. I think we can think about alternatives that would overcome the very issues that you're pointing out regarding the security dilemma. Now, again, people are going to come back and say that's naive. It doesn't take seriously the way the world is. But I think it's just the opposite. I think it's naive to assume that there has to be a bully on the schoolyard. And if our bully's not in charge, then the world's going to go to hell. It might. But what does that say about the world? Says the world's a terrible, horrible place. And perhaps it is, but I like to think that it's not. And I like to think that we have some scope for agency to move beyond that and improve the world. And I think human history shows that. I think through time, many things that were quite brutal and terrible and kind of widely accepted behaviors of how we taught our fellow human beings have gone by the wayside. Because people realized how brutal and terrible they were. And that's not always easy to get there, but that possibility exists.
Well, the U.S. might be somewhat successful, at least domestically, in their forward-facing foreign policy. But the history is also littered with examples of interventionist foreign policies that have led to ruin and countries that actually have destroyed themselves with their attempts to seek out hegemony. I actually don't know in the modern world of any example besides the United States of a country that didn't ruin itself trying to seek like serious hegemony. But I accept that it could be naive. I think holding something like a Swiss neutrality to the standard of, you know, perfection is not a reasonable standard. But is it obviously a much worse strategy for narrow security concerns than a more interventionist foreign policy? It's not obvious to me that's true, and I'm not saying I know that it is. Are you aware of any good, like, systematic historical studies that try to analyze neutrality, non-interventionism, limited pacifism, or something as a security strategy and how it compares to other strategies? I don't know how to look for that, but I've tried in vain.
I don't know. Yeah, that's a great question. I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know anything that looks at systematic studies through time of that strategy versus others.
Or at least since post-Napoleon or something.
There's a great set of books by, this isn't directly on the topic you're asking about, but there's a set of books by a political scientist by the name of Gene Sharp. And Gene Sharp was a political scientist who was famous for his work on civil resistance and nonviolent action. So this idea that you could have collective action to push back against authoritarian regimes within your country, but also invaders, by not resorting to violence. And he wasn't a principled pacifist, so this isn't an ethical argument. It was a practical argument. His argument is that, look, if you have an authoritarian government or if you have someone invading you, oftentimes for the ordinary person, you're just not strong enough to physically fight back. You just can't compete on that margin. But how you can compete is by engaging in nonviolent action, which can be anything from protest to a non-compliance. He has a whole list of different ways of doing this. But in his books, he has all these little case studies of instances where nonviolent action was invoked. He also has a book called Civilian Base Defense, which I think was published by Princeton University Press, which is a very good book on the both the conceptual idea of what you were talking about earlier, of civilians being a defensive force against internal invaders, which is purely internal looking. And he also has historical discussions of where these things have been tried. And again, in many cases, they don't work. You know, in some cases, they fail. But so, of course, does having a military force can fail, too, as you point out earlier, on a variety of margins. And then there's a political scientist at Harvard named Erica Chenoweth, who has also done work on nonviolent action. And they have looked at empirical evidence and collected data on nonviolence. And if I remember the findings of the main book on this that Erica Chenoweth published, it was that nonviolent efforts to combat threats were more successful than violent action. And again, the idea is that nonviolent action is more inclusive because when you rely on physical force, your army to push back is going to be smaller. Just the number of people that are physically capable of fighting is going to be smaller, and you're oftentimes going to get crushed by the stronger force. But nonviolence offers you a broader base or a potential for a broader base that allows you to potentially combat those threats internally and externally. The topic you're raising is a interesting one for future research for scholars that are interested in this, kind of these alternative ways of structuring defense internally, but also a foreign policy of neutrality and what that means externally as well.
Do you have any serious disagreements with other anti-war libertarians, either in terms of principles or empirical disagreements?
Well, you know, it would depend on the specifics, so it's hard for me to make a general claim. I imagine if I talked to anyone, I'd have disagreements on some margin. So from that standpoint, my answer would certainly be yes. Libertarian world's a small one, but then even with the category of libertarians, as I was mentioning earlier,
there are some pretty hawkish libertarians.
Yes, this is what I was going to say. And you saw it throughout history, but you saw it certainly after 9/11. You saw a lot of libertarians, self-stylized libertarians, so I'm not classifying them that way, saying, look, I'm libertarian when it comes to X, Y, and Z domestically, but when it comes to foreign policy, we need to go crush Al-Qaeda and this and that. And so certainly with that category of people, I would have disagreements. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting kind of nuance and open issues as it relates to things like, in libertarian theory, I mean, what does retribution look like? What does retaliation look like? You know, at what point can you prevent someone kind of engage in defensive activities, whether it's a war or not? You know, do you have to actually touch me, or is your eye, you know, kind of like you do to your sibling when you're little?
I'm not touching you.
Yeah, exactly. How, at what point have you violated the rights of another or threatened their rights such that the other person can retaliate? These are tricky questions, and I don't pretend to have an answer to it. My own position, for what it's worth, is I very much subscribe to what political philosophers who talk about these issues would call practical pacifism. And so absolute pacifism is kind of this idea that under no circumstances do you engage in violence. So someone can be engaging in violence against you and you kind of don't retaliate. You sit there.
Like radical Tolstoyan pacifism.
Yeah, yeah. And I can't rule out all instances where I don't think retaliation would not make sense, or if someone was threatening me or my family, that I would proactively try to block that and stop it. What that would entail, it depends on the context. Practical pacifism is basically what you and I were talking about earlier, but we didn't use that term, which is war is such a severely harmful and negative human activity that the bar for engaging in it needs to be extremely high. Now, again, what that extremely high means is open for discussion. But that means that more often than not, war is not going to be justifiable. And our default position should be one of being anti-war. That is, the burden of proof needs to be on those that are proponents of warfare in a certain instance. And there needs to be clear evidence presented that meets a certain burden to go to war. But there also have to be mechanisms in place to ensure that there are lines of accountability that prevent those people from overstepping their bounds. And that's a tough task, but that's kind of the framework that I would think, how I think about these things. That also creates some space for the possibility of warfare. So I can't rule that out. At least that's my current position on these things. But any individual instance of warfare would have to be an extreme outlier, not the norm.
Do you have any general recommendations for works that complement this one well, or anti-war works that you especially like, leaving out your own? Don't forget to please check out this book also and Chris's previous book, In Search of Monsters to Destroy. But do you have any other recommendations?
The way I kind of view this book is as a prequel to that one, in a way. Like, this kind of gets at the core ideas, and then that kind of delves into more of the details. In terms of other works, you know, I'm a very big fan of an economic historian by the name of Robert Higgs, that I know you're familiar with his work on Christ and Leviathan and the Ratchet Effect, because I think we discussed that last time. But
yeah, we did.
He wrote a series of books throughout his career that I think are just extremely powerful treatments of the warfare state and the kind of the political economy of war in general. I think that's wonderful. There's a philosopher by the name of Andrew Fiala, F-I-A-L-A. He's still a practicing philosopher. He's written numerous books on practical pacifism from a philosophical standpoint that I very much benefited from. And, you know, I'm of the position that we can learn from different people from different ideological perspectives. So, you know, I've personally have benefited from reading people like Noam Chomsky, even though I very much disagree with him on many economic issues and other, and even issues related to some matters of national security, I think he's off. But I benefited from his work. You know, historians like Howard Zinn, who has written work on foreign policy and the use of nuclear weapons that I think is quite powerful and useful. And so I think those are all beneficial works. And of course, like the kind of classical thinkers in these areas, Richard Compton and others, who are kind of more historical thinkers, but I think are quite powerful when it comes to matters of peace and war.
Herbert Spencer is a more classical thinker that was always really inspiring to me writing
about
war. Spencer's
great too. Yeah, thank you for raising that. I should have mentioned it. He's great too.
I think partially because I fell victim, I think, to the smearing of Spencer by more modern writers and just assumed he would be a kind of rabid colonialist or something.
Yeah.
And was inspired to see that he very much was not.
Yeah.
I also enjoyed Chomsky and Zinn. Do you think it's a fair criticism to say that their critiques of U.S. foreign policy are very trenchant and on point, but that they have been maybe a little too willing to overlook atrocities of some communist countries and their overreaches?
I certainly think that's a fair critique in certain context. And so if you listen to him speak or read some of his work, certainly his focus is on critiquing the United States and U.S. empire. I'm always hesitant to critique someone without talking to them because someone could make leverage the same critique at me, which is my work is largely focused on the U.S. I have reasons for that. But I also do think it's important for those of us who are critical of kind of the costs and harms of foreign policy to be symmetrical in our critiques and to point out that the U.S. government, through its policy, in my view, has done significant harms across time and space, but many other governments have as well, many others. And so if you look at writings like the political scientist R.J. Rummel, who wrote a book called Death by Government, you know, he points out that in the 20th century, the largest source of death of innocent people was what he classifies as democide. Democide is death by your own government. So it's not international wars. They're talking 20th century here,
it's
too.
It's primarily famines, right? Like man-made famines in communist countries.
Exactly.
In China.
Famines and genocide. So purposeful killing of large numbers of people. And you start looking at where those things occurred. So there are a lot of governments that are extremely brutal. And that's been the nature throughout history. That's stepping back to my kind of broader world philosophy or philosophy of political philosophy. This is why I'm so skeptical of government. You know, I'm so skeptical of government because it is the centralization of power. And when you centralize brute power in the hands of a small group of people, I think it's more likely than not they're going to use it to harm people. One of the reasons I focus on the U.S. government, again, it's my home country, but also because I think that many people run the risk of oftentimes giving the U.S. government a pass because they'll say, you know, the shining city on the hill kind of logic, that it's the harbinger of democracy and liberty and peace. And that neglects the real harm that many of its policies does. But also, I think China, Russia, you go right down the list, brutal governments. But my own view, again, is that's a defining feature of governments, is brutality. That's what they do. If we kind of take the Weberian notion of a government as a monopoly on force, What do you expect a monopoly on force to do? I think they're going to use force. And so we should recognize that and be aware of it.
What's next for you?
I don't know. This book will come out in June. I'm going to take a break from foreign policy books for a little bit. Abby and I are working on a kind of an introductory book to Austrian economics that will probably be out sometime in hopefully 2025. But, you know, I'm still working on numerous journal articles and academic articles on foreign policy. And then this past year, I started something called the Initiative for the Study of for a Stable Peace. And it's a virtual community of scholars who are interested in the topics that you and I have been discussing today. They don't have to be libertarian leanings. They can be of any ideology. I'm just interested in getting a group of scholars together, interdisciplinary, who are interested in peace studies from all different variety of perspectives. So we have economists, political scientists, religious studies, and we meet virtually to have kind of discussions over reading groups. We have paper seminars. And so I'm trying to build up a community of scholars to study and explore these topics and hopefully to encourage more research on them. That's kind of a side project I've been working on as well, in addition to my academic work.
That's exciting. Where can people find you?
My main website is ccoyne.com, so C-C-O-Y-N-E. That's my homepage page, which has all my academic work and links to all my other kind of projects and initiatives like the one I just mentioned.
My guest today has been Chris Coyne, and his book, once again, co-authored with Abigail Hall, is called How to Run Wars, A Confidential Playbook for the National Security Elite, and that'll be out on June 18th. Chris, thank you once again for joining me on Ideas Having Sex.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Ideas Having Sex, where we have stimulating conversations on social science, philosophy, history, politics, and more. If you're a fan of what I do, please take a minute to subscribe to the show and to give us a rating and review wherever you listen. I'm Chris Kaufman. Thanks for listening.